previously.tv podcast network.
There was really not any normal anymore because Sacramento was in a state of fear.
Plan on taking any precautions?
I put locks on my doors. Peepholes in just last week, yeah.
I don't know, I have a gun, but I still don't feel safe being, you know, at home alone.
I imagine a lot of women in the area are scared and are nervous. If they could just kind of get to know each other's habits, their neighbors' habits, and call in if they see or hear anything suspicious at all.
It took the untimely death of Michelle McNamara, author of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, to introduce me to the case of the East Area rapist slash Golden State Killer, and as yet unapprehended unsub, himself responsible for a dozen untimely deaths and five times as many sexual assaults in the 70s and 80s. Investigation Discovery gets in on the act with The Golden State Killer, It's Not Over, and my guest gets in on The Blotter Presents' first book club as we discuss both the show and McNamara's posthumously published book. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 48. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on all things TV true crime. I am joined for the first, but hopefully not the last time, by Mike Dunn, who I've known since God was a child. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I am fine. I am. We're having some tech problems today, and I realized that one of them was actually user error. I completely forgot to write a case file section for today's most wanted and cold case. But we are beginning with Investigation Discovery's two-night, four-hour event from last week, The Golden State Killer, It's Not Over, which is basically like it's the TV kind of version of Michelle McNamara's book. But here's the brief, and Mike, you can correct me if you think I'm getting anything wrong. The East Area rapist started out in Sacramento area in the late 70s and broke into myriad homes, sexually assaulted myriad women, sometimes with husbands present, sometimes with children present, striking sometimes twice in 24 or 36 hours, often the same neighborhood hit three times in a month. And at some point in the early 80s, he moves to Southern California, becomes who they call him, the original Night Stalker, and then he starts killing people. They're pretty sure this is the same guy. They're pretty sure he's out there somewhere. But he's still never been caught. And with the publication at last of McNamara's book, all of a sudden, this is very much a case that is in the true crime, not aficionado, you know what I mean? It's in the consciousness, in the genre. Right. This all kicked off because you sent me a text of the cover of McNamara's book. And
I think the day after it was released, I was already at Barnes & Noble online. It's like, I need to get
this now. I had completely forgotten that I pre-ordered it, and I was like, it was just like sitting in an Amazon box. I didn't even remember which pre-order it was, because I'm that guy. Then I was like, all right, well, let's do a book club, and then we'll, you know, maybe they've done a 48 hours on this. And then Investigation Discovery dropped this show a few days after that. But why were you interested in this book? Was it because of McNamara?
It actually was because of McNamara, being a longtime Patton Oswalt fan and hearing about what his wife was doing for a living. And I know that she has her own true crime blog, which I must admit I have not spent that much time on. But then just feeling really, really sad when I heard about Michelle passing away and not even knowing about her true crime blog at that point, just, you know, the affinity and affection that I had for Patton and knowing that she had to be a really, really special person, that I found out about the work that she was doing in regards to tracking the Garden State. Oh my God, my New Jersey's coming out. The Golden State Killer. And I became interested in especially when I heard that she had been working on a book that was going to be completed with the assistance of a couple other researchers that I think Patton basically just said, here's all of Michelle's information. Can you please finish this for me? So that's what drew me in initially. So then when the book got released, I just said to myself, I need to go out and get this right away because I've heard nothing but amazingly good things in regards to the work that she does and what her blog represents and how many people really like it.
Same here, pretty much. I had never heard of this. Yeah. I mean, it's like California, not, you know, Greenland.
Right.
I never heard of this case. This is a staggering number of victims. This is a staggering number of strikes.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not like California has really any shortage of... murder, but like, hi, like we're recording this in, you know, Bay Ridge, Brooklyn right now.
Right.
And Polly Walnuts literally lives down the street. you know, we're from Jersey. Like it's not whatever,
yeah.
But it's like that volume of crimes by a single perpetrator.
Yeah.
It was pretty shocking that I'd never heard of it before. And like you, Patton Oswalt has sort of fallen off a little bit in my esteem in the last few years, just because he's been some ways on Twitter that I was like, I need to just not deal with you anymore. But basically, he's a good egg. You and I have seen him at when he was opening for Amy Mann and Michael Penn. I think we saw him a few times on that tour.
Or being part of that show, actually.
Yeah.
Interspersed in the middle to do the to do Amy's... what do you call it? In between song banter.
Oh, yeah. That she's like, I have outsourced the patter to Ben.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, he's very funny. I have his albums still kicking around on my on my iTunes, and was just, you know, very struck when his wife passed away. Like, that's just a, I mean, horrible thing to happen. They had a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
I believe he's since married again, and they're sort of a happy, different family now, which is great. But I was particularly struck by, like, how did I not know that she did this? Is A, and B, he, I mean, not that like smart people who are good with language can't or don't get married to, you know, clunky prose stylists, but it's like she must be a good writer too,
right?
And she has the same interest and the same like belief that she can crack cases. That is part of why anyone is attracted to true crime, I think, is that like feeling that you can control the environment by understanding it. Anyway, that was my entry into the case as well. I think Investigation Discovery's entry into the case and ID has, definitely like upped their class levels in the last, I would say, year or 2 years. But this was definitely something where I think they had, they knew when the drop date was of this book and they were absolutely planning to maximize that, which is fine. But it was like a four-parter in 2 days.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's not actually badly done. Once again, it's called The Golden State Killer, It's Not Over, which I keep almost calling This Is Not Over because I used to have a like politics blog back when W got reelected. Were we ever so young and like wrongly pissed off about the president?
And it's just carried forward.
Yes. So I was like, I don't know. This seems like kind of a lot. But it's pretty well done for what it is. Did you watch all four parts?
I did watch all four parts. I felt maybe they could have done it all in three. I mean, I think that there may have been some parts of the show that I liked more than others. And it's just some things that I thought they could have maybe just could have done a little bit more editing on, personally.
Yeah, probably. They did do a good job presenting like the victims that they spoke to. These stories are very affecting regardless, and they did a good job sort of staying out of their own way and not like trying to gin up more drama mm-hmm. about the testimony from these women, as we will hear in clip two.
The next thing I knew, there he was shining this light in my eyes, and all I could see was his ski mask and the butcher knife. And he said,
shut up, or I'll kill you,
with clenched teeth. So you can imagine the fear, especially with my 3-year-old son laying next to me.
I mean, this aspect of the guy, just that he, I mean, often like pets are in the house, dogs that always bark wouldn't bark. So he had obviously been kind of, you know, casing the joint, like had been to these properties before, like that, you know, that a kid would sort of half wake up but not start crying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe that was Jane Carson, right? And I think she was victim number 5 that we heard on that clip.
I think
clip.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
I was amazed in regards to how open the victims that they used on the show were to continue discussing this. I mean, I would probably just like still to this day, like curl up in a fetal position and say, I just don't want to talk about this anymore, you know, especially for, you know, for broadcast, because I know that there's been discussions that some of the victims still wish to remain anonymous. And just don't want their name out there out of fear that even though that this guy is probably in his 60s at this point, that they still have that fear that he might come back.
Or is incarcerated or is dead. Like, right. You know, sort of actuarially speaking and based on, you know, what mm-hmm. we all know, because we all think profiling experts, thanks to, you know, Criminal Minds or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, accept myself from that indictment, but it's like, yeah, he's probably locked up or dead.
Yeah.
But I mean, you don't know, but you don't know. And he did call some of these people years later.
Yes.
Or someone pretending to be him, which is even more fucked up. But the other thing about this is like these are sexual crimes and they were committed at a time when like SVU wasn't in its 19th season. Mm-hmm. We weren't so enlightened about, you know, the reporting of this and the prevalence of this kind of crime. And they found this during the investigation and still are struggling with it, as we'll hear from Detective Carol Daly, who is kind of all over both. I don't know how much she's in the book comparatively, but she's definitely all over the first two episodes, and she's shown in contemporary footage, just advising people chillingly. I think that she's like, if you try to injure this guy, get him good. Don't just piss him off.
Yeah,
disable him.
I was gonna say there was some for some reason. I was gonna say the word decapitate, but it wasn't decapitate. But it was something just as strong that she was saying in that town hall meeting. She was like, "You really, really need to seriously damage this person if you are going to strike back." That
absolutely.
You know, just slapping him in the face, you're just gonna make him angrier. And obviously, don't do that.
Yeah, I think not that anyone necessarily got the opportunity. He was pretty consistent about tying victims up hog tie style, but there are details that even though police might know what occurred during the crime based on, you know, evidence like semen that was left wherever it was left, whatever, the survivors are like unable to bring themselves to say exactly what happened even to this day. And Carol Daly talks about that in clip 3.
Some of the victims felt that he was so immaturely small in the penis, which became a big issue in this investigation. And yes, I know of one victim who to this day has never admitted that oral copulation was a part of the act because it was just so embarrassing to her. So as much as you think you're doing thorough and getting all of the information, years later, you know that there was still something that the victim did not want to come forward with because it was so embarrassing.
Carol Daly has a certain way of putting things that is really interesting. Like, and on top of that, like her like bridge work doesn't fit quite right. So she has this like badass auntie way of delivering what she's saying, but then also immaturely small in the penis.
I'm looking at that exact phrase in my written notes right now in quotes. I'm not kidding. Immaturely small in the penis. It's
yeah. Like, I mean, I think 100 monkeys in 100 years to say that suspect had a small dick would never come up with that particular phrasing.
Right.
And it's, well, I'm not going to use the word chewy, but oh dear. Oh, I seem to have just, yeah,
oh,
sorry.
Went there. You went there.
I did. but yeah, she, you'll see this, if you follow us on social media, which is both Facebook and Twitter at Blotter Presents. I cut a picture of her going through her, like case book.
Yes.
And there's a picture of her at the firing range looking like a complete
badass. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the late 70s, to be a detective and investigating this series of crimes was difficult for everyone. But then she, on top of that, is like sort of the nominated liaison.
Yeah. And in regards to Dilly, if I could just jump in, there was one thing that I really, really liked is that I guess the lead investigator now, his name is Paul Holes. And him, well,
yeah.
Okay. Immaturely small in the penis, Paul Holes.
Yeah. Paul Holes. It's pronounced Holes. It's not.
That's right. It is California.
It's not.
You know, he was at Contra Costa, was where he's from. So it's Holes.
Yes.
But just it like seeing that, you know, especially in cold cases like this, you usually don't hear like where the new investigators that have been assigned to the cold case is giving much credit to the previous investigators and the previous work that was done. And just hearing Holes just say, the notes that she gave me and the files that she gave me were freaking awesome and have been such a big help. So I was really, really glad to hear that, you know, there wasn't much shitting on for the previous investigations, you know, given that, you know, this is still an open case and there's 60 attacks such.
And I would say that goes both ways, that certainly the older investigators are like, they're eager for this to get solved and they're eager to help out.
Yes.
If they're still living and able to remember things or they still have case files. So,
right.
And you see that in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm, you know, the book is definitely a big part of, if not the main reason, that we're watching this show, as you'll hear in clip 4.
True crime author Michelle McNamara worked this case for years on her own, sending law enforcement tips as she uncovered them. McNamara died unexpectedly in 2016, but a community of dedicated citizen sleuths continues to study the case.
Some of these people are extremely bright, and they have contributed to the investigation.
Mike Morford is a true crime blogger and podcast host.
This case is one where you start looking at a map, you start looking at some locations, and then things start playing in your mind, and then you start getting the bug to seeing if you can figure out something to solve it.
Okay. The other reason is the internet. Here's the thing. Like, Mike Morford is good at this. He's one of the co-hosts of the Criminology podcast, which I don't listen to, but that's only because I literally don't have time to listen to any podcasts, including the ones that I make with my own face hole. So it's like I subscribe to it. I've just never really like sat with it for a whole season or anything like that. I believe he's also the head nerd in charge at Zodiac Revisited, and I've, you know, been through that site, and I think he does good work.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that I had kind of overall with the use of Morford and also
Keith
guy's
Komos.
Name? Yes, Komos. Is that the show couldn't seem to decide. I mean, these are also authors, these guys, so just call them authors. But I felt like the show wanted us to. Okay, The other thing is, like, I watched that whole Maura Murray series and, like, the quote citizen sleuths that they had on that one.
Mm-hmm. I felt was, in regards to these two, is that the conversations that Morford and Comos were having with each other just didn't feel natural. I mean, you know, with a true crime documentary, you're going to get a lot of reenacted scenes, but you don't necessarily want the reenacted scenes with two people that are talking to each other about the case and what it is they're working on. You know, it felt a little fake when they started talking about the badge. I mean, I just kept thinking to myself, you guys have known about the badge probably for weeks. And you know what? I bet that the police departments and the investigators and the detectives have known about this badge, and we're looking up the history of this badge for weeks as well. So when they kind of use that the antic or the method in a documentary like this to basically say, oh, well, if we find out about this badge, it's going to just burst the case wide open. And it's in episode one, and it's part four, and it's a four-part episode. It's a tactic that I'm not very much a fan of. I think.
Well, and also, like, reenactments are performed by actors.
Right.
Maybe it's a little silent movie because they're not, you don't hear them and there's a voiceover, whatever. But these are actors. Like, when you're basically having investigators who might not be used to being on camera, having to, like, stagily reenact a conversation they already had. Like, this is why when, like, you and I were just talking about some of this stuff before we got on mic, and I was like, save it, because I didn't want it to, you know, be canned.
Right.
I mean, this is a real problem when my husband is the guest. He's like, you know what my problem is with that? I'm like, I'm sure I'll find out on the podcast. Don't tell me. La, 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 la.
No dinner conversation tonight. None. Stop it.
Yeah. But it also was a little, the show was a little, not undiscerning, but I think it's important to distinguish between, like, there's a lot of bullshit, like, Reddit herring investigating that goes on the internet.
Right.
The internet is like anything else. 80% of it is garbage. And I felt like the show could have been a little more, it couldn't seem to decide whether to accept these guys' bona fides or not. Mm-hmm. And I mean, all right, I'm actually going to skip ahead to clip six, because this is sort of an example of what I mean about the show kind of not knowing what it thinks about how embedded the internet sort of is in both the book and, like, the investigation generally out in the world.
With only a handful of clues in such a massive case, the online community has become a key part of the investigation. Parsing data, using crowdsourcing, and digging deep for information.
We're sitting here at 9 o'clock at night while the rest of the world is doing something else, going through this and really making headway. It becomes more than a hobby. It starts to become a community.
This is what I'm talking about. Like, who do they think is watching this?
Mm-hmm.
And what year do they think it is when we're watching? Like, the internet has been ubiquitous for a while.
Right.
True crime as a, like, it's not a corner of the internet anymore. And certainly Michelle McNamara was very upfront about doing, you know, letting her fingers do the walking on the internet to investigate this case. Like, she, you know, she definitely did in-person interviews and went to scenes and stuff.
Mm-hmm. But then she was also looking for, you know, some of the stolen items on eBay. She goes into in the book that they don't do on the show in regards to this pair of cufflinks that were found that she swore were the cufflinks stolen from a particular site, and falling into that trap of, this is going to be it. This is the thing that's going to find the killer, and then having her heart broken, which is what I think all citizen sleuths are thinking. It's like, oh, if we find this one thing, we are going to save the day, and we will find this guy based on this one little iota of evidence that we're going to be able to research and find. And I think it's so much more than that. I mean, I'm still convinced this case is going to be solved on DNA evidence and nothing else. You know, that there will be a familial response to it that will eventually lead to who the killer is, and it's not going to have anything to do with, like I said, with cufflinks or a badge or anything of that sort.
Or anything else that, I mean, And it's always tempting, especially in the world that we do live in of overturned and wrongful convictions, that it's like, you know, we the people may know better than investigators from 30 and 40 years ago because we have tools that they didn't. But if the tool is just like, you know, I mean, I was a records clerk. I can track some of this shit down, no problem. On the other hand, I find it very relatable just because, like, I'm the family genealogy nerd. My great-grandfather had this one brother that, like, it took us forever to even find proof besides my grandmother's word that he existed. And finding it in a rainy cemetery outside Philadelphia, I thought it was queen shit of fuck mountain. Like, I get it. I get it, but it's like, okay, the show, I think, is like, it's like they're speaking to like 75 or 80 year olds who are like, well, the internet's only good for pornography and ordering my diabetes medication. Like, are you fucking kidding? Like, we all know what's going on here. And some of us have been burned by podcasts about Maura Murray. I'm not willing to just take the word of, you know, whoever on a message board. Like, I think that true crime properties generally need to find a more reliable and universal way to establish a contributor's bona fides. And this is, again, not a knock on Morford, who has bona fides in this department. I just feel like the show was a little squishy about it, and also put him and Comos in the position of, like, hiring an audio analyst.
That segment actually gave me a headache. It really did.
Oh my God. Mine too. All right, here's the setup. There is a recording of the Golden State Killer, the East Side Rapist, or whoever he was at that in his evolution at that time, calling back a previous victim and, like, heavy breathing on her. The police had put a recording device on her phone. Yes. They play it and they're like, oh, there's someone talking in the background. And if we can just track down who that is.
Mm-hmm. I think it was the first victim too, actually.
I believe you're right. I believe he called, and it was like, it wasn't that long after. I think he had quote only gotten up to like five or six more victims. I don't recall exactly. And I believe this is in the book, although the audio it isn't, because Michelle McNamara is not an idiot. But anyway, spoiler. So it's immediately clear to me that the voices in the background are TV.
Oh my God. It was so crystal clear.
There's just something about the timbre that immediately I was like, TV.
Mm-hmm.
So the audio analyst, whose eyebrow narrative is amazing, P.S. I'll try to get a screenshot of that for social media. He basically is like, well, it's hard to tell. It sounds like two women, whatever he says. But then the wherever they, like, web sleuths or whichever board they were on, realized, like, they found the listings.
That's right. They found the newspaper listing of what was on TV the night of the murder.
Yeah.
Or of the attack, excuse me.
Yeah, and there's, like, only, or no, the night of the call.
Right.
There were, like, only three channels back then, and there was only one. There was a show that matched up with the sound of this dialogue, and they, like, did a transcript and everything, and I'm like, that is cool, processy shit. Yeah. But unfortunately, I was there 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And it puts Morford and Comos in the position of being like, well, that's disappointing. Like, of course you knew it was TV. Well, you're not stupid.
It was disappointing, but then they also referred to it as a breakthrough. Like, so it's a breakthrough of something to push to the side for the investigation, which I'm guessing that because the citizens lose. And I don't keep, they're doing great work. And I know that, you know, that they say that, you know, we present our evidence and such to
hey,
Paul
look,
Holes.
Citizens cracked the Zodiac code. Nothing against citizens.
Yeah. You know, they're thankful for the information that they're getting. They follow up on it, and they're actually told, yeah, we'll keep, you know, if you find something, keep it, send it to us and we'll take a look at it. But then when they refer to that sound being a breakthrough, and I was like, yeah, it was a breakthrough and something to not to be considered anymore. And I don't think it was very high on the priority list to begin with. So,
well, yeah. And they should have just been like, okay, what is the, Like, someone should have said at some point, like, this is probably just TV.
Yeah.
In the background, because he called during prime time. Anyway, let's just hear the clip, which is clip 7.
The online sleuth community developed an interesting theory.
On page A7 of the Sacramento Union, January 2nd, 1978, we have a listing of TV movies. Some people online noticed that the dialogue from one of these movies seems to match the background of this call.
Uh-huh. That is an interesting theory.
Mm-hmm.
It was just as interesting, by which I mean not really, when I came up with it immediately upon it. Oh, God. I mean, look, this goes back to your point.
Yeah.
Yeah. This goes back to your point that, like, get this done in 3 hours and not four.
Yeah. And the only thing I really wanted to know was, what TV movie was it? Was it like Rich Man, Poor Man? was it?
I know, right? Shogun.
Yeah, exactly. One of those like great 70s miniseries.
Yeah. Oh, man. And I think they do show the page. I think if you guys go back and watch this online, and we will link to the series in our show notes, I'm pretty sure you can watch it on Investigation Discovery's website, depending on your cable provider. And I think it's also just, it's out there in the world. But if you are watching it, I think they do show mimeograph of the sheet of the listings.
Yeah, it looks like it was just the top of the page that they showed and maybe like the first three or four listings. But like you said, it was like, what, ABC, CBS, and NBC back in the day in the 70s. Yeah. And that's it. So,
and in some areas, you didn't get all of those. Like, for my grandmother to watch her stories on NBC outside Philadelphia took some tinfoil and a whole lot of prayer.
Yep.
This case is still not solved. No one has. It's not even like in the cases that haunt us where John Douglas will be like, I'm pretty sure it was actually this guy, or like that Ripper book that where he's like, it was probably Aaron Kosminski or whoever he said it was.
Yeah.
Spoiler, it wasn't him. But they're still looking for this guy. And although this was actually clip 5, it'll be our last clip in this section where both Paul Holes, and it is Holes, it's not Holes.
Holes in his name, Holes in this case.
Oh, God. There you go. And Carol Daly talk a little bit about how he's managed to blend into the woodwork for so long and what is finally going to pop him out if he's ever caught. That's clip 5.
His car fits into that neighborhood. His clothing fits into that neighborhood. So people in these types of neighborhoods don't see this guy. He just kind of comes and goes because he blends in. He looks just like them.
Look at the people who for years have lived next door to a neighbor and then they're arrested for an old murder, and yet they've been an outstanding citizen. They've married and they've had a family. I have believed all along that somebody knew who the rapist was, whether it was a mother, a girlfriend, a close friend. We had so much information out there about him, about his clothing. We knew he wore a size 9 shoe. And then you have somebody who is taking trinkets from all of the rapes, pictures, driver's license, jewelry, that he would have in his possession. I just feel like somebody knew. And that person either is deceased or just has chosen not to come forward.
I think with the trophies, he tended to leave them either like two houses down or two victims later. He would leave them. Like, I don't think he actually held on to.
Right.
A lot of this stuff, but her the rest of her point is well taken. I mean, wasn't that who was the guy in Jersey who had killed his whole family and then just started over? List?
Oh, dear Lord.
Wasn't he living in Westfield when we were kids?
I
came and got him.
Don't recall, to be honest with you, but probably almost not too far from the same time frame.
Yeah, I think it was like a few years after this guy moved to Southern California.
Yeah.
This is not badly done, but I like at a certain point, like I stopped after the second one and was just like, I don't need both of these when I'm in the middle of the book. And I would say you don't need both of these and you may only need the book, but I mean, I wasn't super crazy about the book.
Oh, really?
And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. So, moving on to the second half of our Most Wanted. Here's my thing with the book.
Okay.
First of all, it's good. Overall, it's good. I will say that it is a B. The writing is pretty good for this genre, although that is really not saying a lot. But when you start with an epigraph from Weldon Keyes, who himself is kind of a great unsolved mystery, that's a bold fucking move. You better be able to hang. And I don't. Here's my frustration, and I don't actually think this is her fault.
Okay.
I couldn't figure out who had actually edited this book. There was like acknowledgments of because she, you know, passed away.
Right.
I think they did an excellent job working with her notes to create good narrative flow. The pacing is very good. There's some footnotes from her sort of posthumous authors on her evolving understanding of certain situations that she had written like a couple years before that. There are some nice turns of phrase in there. Like when she's talking about where she grew up, the houses were always a few degrees too cold and the beds lacked headboards. Like that's a nice bit of business.
And how that's what prompted her about where she grew up being her initiation into looking into true crime, right? There was a murder that took place like on the street that she lived in.
Correct.
And, I can't remember the, I don't think it had a particular case name or anything like that, but it was what, it was a case that I guess turned cold and it, what drove her to go into this.
Yeah. She also has a note, it's on page 174, where she says that, I think it's Paul Holes, quote, later underscored how tricky suspect assessment is by pointing out that just based on geographic history and physical description, a good Golden State Killer suspect would be Tom Hanks.
Yes.
And then she goes on to say that his bosom buddy's schedule would eliminate him. Like she just makes sure to say like, you know, it's definitely not him.
Yeah. And when I saw like the sketches of the suspect, I just kept thinking to myself, given that this is, you know, this took place in the 70s, I was like, that looks like every character from Dazed and Confused that you've drawn here.
Yeah.
You know, like
it does.
The exact same blonde hair and short and haircut and the description of how they were dressed, you know, Levi's jeans, t-shirt, you know, it's like, yeah, that's the 1970s basically.
Yeah. Like, oh, him. Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
But, so I would say that it's like, I mean, it's mostly well written, but there is a particular locution that she uses repeatedly and it just bugs the shit out of me. Like the first one is on page 27. It bugged me immediately and it came up another half dozen times.
Okay.
It goes like this. Flash bulbs deluged. Attention shifted. Clamor ratcheted. Okay, here's the thing. Your girl died, and she's not here to get herself out of her own way with, and look, we all have these writing tics. Your editor is supposed to step in and get them out. He's supposed to sift the turds out of the pristine kitty litter of your work. That was a horrible metaphor. As you can see, we all need editor's help. I'm all on my own out here. This is not how these nouns work. The forcing of these verbs into intransitives doesn't really either. Like, I don't know if this was just a thing that she did, but it's straining for this like jazzy Elmore Leonard, James Ellroy something that doesn't land. It just keeps coming back like a zit next to your nose. And I simply don't see why.
And
particularly
I'm sorry,
a project
yeah.
that was going to be this well-known as a posthumous gathering of resources wouldn't have done Ryder by its primary late author by getting rid of that shit and of a phrase like the devouring force in his angry eyes, which I am angry about, page 213. Go to your copy right now, listeners. Cross it out so you can think well of Michelle McNamara. It's what she deserves. I think that's all my complaints. Yeah.
And especially your initial quote. And it wasn't even in regards to anything having to do with the case. It was about her being at a premiere with Patton. It was like, yeah. Seriously, you could just be describing that you're at the premiere and this is what it's like. And yet here I am checking on my phone because I might be getting an email about particular clues or something that I've been following up on or something that I've been waiting to hear back
on. That part was perfectly relatable that she's like, so I was at a premiere and then was trying not to let Patton know or anyone else know. Like she's trying to sneak out of this thing and someone's like, oh, back home to baby, because their daughter was 3 months old. And she's like, I thought that was awesome. That she's like, oh, right, Alice, sure. Like, all right. Like she definitely has... like sometimes that very like short, punchy, almost Hemingway-y way of putting things is good. Like that she in one brushstroke can give you a lot. Like when she says, she's talking about how different it is to talk to detectives and how compared to the people she's usually around, quote, I'm constantly surrounded by big expressions and detectives are very interior and do much more listening.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I thought that was excellent, but there is a lot of, and again, for this genre, it's not even anything that bad. I just was like annoyed on her behalf that they didn't cut that shit. 'Cause she's better than that, basically.
Although I liked one comparison that she made, and I forget which investigator or detective that it was that she was talking to, who could come across a little bit gruff. But she understood where he was coming from. And then she compared it to, well, sometimes I have to listen to an actress complain about three lines that she had in a movie and dissecting it and going over it for like an hour. And I'm like, it's three lines. Seriously?
Yeah.
Give me a break. And it's probably
section that she's like, I've listened to an actress complain for 5 minutes about a one-line text that hurt her feelings. Like, we've been there. But yeah, like there's a lot of good writing in here. And I like on the big stuff, she's good. Like there are a lot of true crime books that you're like, that they'll just stop everything and be like, part two, picture it, Sicily, 1904. And you're like, oh, come on. Like, who's editing this? And, you know, but there's a couple, like, there's a whole explanation of how DNA testing works in 2018, in a true crime book in 2018. Who left that in? That she's like, just for the layperson, like, the layperson knows. We all fucking live through OJ. Who is this for? And whatever editor made you put that in, like, that's not a network note you needed to listen to. Take it out.
Oh. One of the elements that I did really like about the book, I'm just going to add real quick, is that, you know, I grew up in the 70s. You know, those are my grammar school years, you know, basically 1 to 10. And what I think she really did a great job of was setting up the fear that it was not just in California, you know, where there was, you know, the Golden State Killer or the East Area Rapist. You know, in New York, we had Son of Sam. We had David Berkowitz. It was kind of like a cross-country kind of thing where something like this was happening, maybe not everywhere, but there was something similar to it that was happening for me in New Jersey where we did live in a community where we did keep the back door unlocked. And then Son of Sam came out and there was a major blackout and everyone was like, get inside, lock the windows, lock the doors now. You know, like it did ring very true hearing and how she wrote, you know, that particular aspect of what the 70s were like. She did have
a good way. Like she also didn't over describe like the things that made the 70s the 70s. Like she didn't underline those signifiers too hard, which everyone is always tempted to do. Like there's a couple of places that she does it, but compared to what you're expecting, like she has a pretty light touch with that stuff. So,
yeah, I don't think she mentioned how this was like post-Vietnam, like Paul Holes did in the documentary, in regards to the type of person that they were looking for. You know, we're like, you know, this was the era of the draft. And the Air Force Base was not too far from Sacramento. So we could be looking at a frustrated military person, because obviously, you know, one of the things they found was that military-style boots were worn, or and military-style pants were worn. I guess maybe they were camouflage or something. But she doesn't really touch onto it that much, that or if at all. To be honest, I don't even remember if she did, but Holes did in the documentary.
Yeah, and there's also they don't get too much into it, I don't think, in the book. But the idea that there was another person, I wish they'd gotten into that a bit more in the book anyway. But overall, like, worthwhile. And it's a very fast read. And I'm hoping that people who are listening, like, that locution bugged me. It's probably not going to bug most people. And now that you know what's coming, that it's like, oh, they should have edited that. Like, well, get used to it. But if you know it's coming, maybe it doesn't bother you that much. But overall, I think it's a pretty good, especially since they had to piece it together. I thought it was good. And there's an afterword by Patton that is just right. Like, hits the tone just right and is really sweet. And I wish that she were still around so that I could dig into True Crime Diary with her still here and see, because you do get a good sense of her. And like, even though some of this writing is like clank-a-doodle-doo, I feel like she's like our people. I feel like we would hang out with her and like, just, I don't know, have some gin and shoot the shit about whichever crime in New Jersey that she'd be like, oh, have you heard about this one? Like, you know, she was a friend we didn't get to make. So in that sense, her writing is excellent because she gives you a sense of her.
Yeah, but in the same tone, it seemed like she was always in bed anyway. So getting her up out of bed may have been difficult.
I know.
You know. It always seemed
It's even in the pictures in the middle of the book.
Yeah, it was like, where was her desk? In bed, just with my laptop open and digging away. And oh, here's me with my daughter. You know, she's helping me take notes next to me.
And she took a lot of notes in crayon. I thought was a cute detail. Like,
But I'll say it was a scary book to me too. I mean, I literally was like reading this book usually at night, you know, in my living room with only like my reading light on, and I would hear one crack outside the house. I was like, lock the doors. Oh shit. You know, it really, really did create elements of fear and suspense in regards to what these victims were going through, and that it could have happened anywhere. And the pictures that
she also did
the pictures it painted of prowling. And yeah, that was another thing I remember from the 70s. We didn't call them prowlers in the 70s when I was a kid. We had peeping toms. We had peeping toms who were just like kids looking in windows, hoping to see a naked woman. And then you see this guy and the elements and the distance he would go to in regards to parking himself for like hours at a time underneath a window behind a hedge, waiting for someone to come back in the house that they could look at. It really made the hairs on my arms just stand straight up and creeped me out to no end. And the
investigator's also saying like prowling is not that hard to do well.
Right.
Because of humans need to, first of all, you know, be in denial / believe the best about people, you know, pick your flavor of, it's basically the same comment, pick whether you're an optimist, but also that pattern recognition means that people just like smooth over anything that doesn't fit. And like, apparently it's just not that hard. And like, it actually really isn't that hard. Like, again, as a records clerk, you know, I was an alumni records clerk. It's not like I was really trying to get any like terrible information. I didn't work for like a, you know, collections agency or whatever.
Right.
But alumni records exist so that alumni development can track these people down and ask them for money. And, you know, people want to believe you. Like, I was asked to prove who I was before information was given to me 3 times in 3 years.
Wow.
And sometimes I was asking for, like, I mean, Barnard has some famous alumni, like, and they were just like, oh yeah, she moved and here's the address. Like, what are you doing? I mean, thank you. I'm not going to do anything with it, but
right.
Same kind of principle. Like, it's actually pretty easy to creep on people because people, for the most part, don't expect to be prepped on.
Right.
And this guy was a lot of things, almost all of them bad, but dumb and unprepared. He was not.
No, he was not.
So, yeah, I thought that she did a good job, maybe a little bit fillery, talking about, like, the ways that detectives are.
Mm-hmm.
But then that would always pay off in terms of the way that they're sort of general insights about, you know, about perpetrators, about burglars, about prowlers were phrased. Like, I thought she did a good job building that. And especially that detail.
And especially developing the relationships with the early on investigators in regards to living in this new world of CSI and DNA evidence and the like, and them still cooperating with her in regards to, you know, sitting down with her, doing interviews, or driving around where some of the crime scenes took place, or just responding to simple emails, to questions that she had. You know, the fact that they were still able to do this in this new world of how crime investigation is done, I thought was it says a lot about her, you know, and in regards to how she went about, you know, doing her research and getting her resources and getting the information. And I got to admit, it crushed me in regards to what you said earlier in regards to, you know, she would have been great. She is someone we would have hung out with and like, hey, let's go have a beer and shoot the crap. And what killed me right away when I opened the book, like what you were saying before about lack of acknowledgments was the lack of a dedication at the front of the book. It's like, it's not dedicated to anybody. And that's like one of the sad aspects of this, that for all this work that she did, that it's... You know, I mean, I'm sure she would have probably sent it out to every victim that ended up being, the inspiration for this book being written and such. But not seeing her be able to write that and say those words was really sad.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know. I'm pretty sure I know who picked the Weldon Keyes quote. And listeners, you should really just Google that if you're not familiar with his story. That's Weldon, like Glenn Weldon, Keyes, K-E-E-S. Okay, so I would have to say, on balance, it might take a little longer to get through, but not much. I would say book over show, if you have to pick one. Mike?
Yes, I would say. If the show was edited, I would say it would be in a good accompaniment, because there are some things in the show that weren't in the book and vice versa, but you're going to get more information and a lot closer to the mentality and thinking of this killer. And hearing more from the victims in the book than you would the show. Like I said, I did like the show, but like you, I did prefer the book more so. And that's what I would lean towards.
Folks, we would love to hear from you about what you thought of the book and what you thought of what we thought of the book. You can find our discussion area on our forums. That's forums.previously.tv or previously.tv/forums will also take you to the same place. We'd love to hear from you about any and all topics that we've discussed on the show. Mike, where else might listeners find you? I believe you're done employed right now.
I am done employed and fun employed presently. So, yeah, you can find me in my house looking for a job on the internet, basically. But also you can find me on Twitter at Mikey. WM free, F-R-E-E, not three anymore, since they are now free. And who knows, one of these days you might see me open up a blog writing about music or something like that, or maybe even putting together an email of sorts. I don't know.
Yes. Don't tease me, folks. I've been begging him to get Shows of Note back on the rails for a pretty long time now. All right. That's all we have for you this week in my continuing endeavor to keep Mike Dunn off the streets. Thank you, Mike, for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. It was
Little site business. The pod is on furlough next week. It's birthday week, and I'm going to be sleeping / reading a giant stack of true crime books. After that, we'll be talking about Trust with Toby Ball. Apparently, this iced tea, cold as ice true crime show is actually a thing. We'll be talking about that. And Investigation Discovery climbs the staircase. Not 100 on how that's going to work, but we will take a look. Got something to add to our case files? Visit our forums, like I said, previously.tv/forums, or hit me on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest is Mike Dunn. You can find him on Twitter at MikeyWMFree. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. We'll talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.